So we've been just kind of recapping, really, today, just going over where we've come from and just gives us a chance to absorb and assimilate and make connections. And we finished the morning going into just sitting via metta. And while we were focusing on positive emotion, we also did a little work with heart wish. Just, I think I made it sound rather simple, just tapping into your heart wish for yourself and others. And since then, I've been talking about, get in touch with your heart wish. I'm aware that it isn't always that simple. But if we can just keep listening in that direction, over time, it becomes clearer what really is driving us, what on a deep level we're motivated by. And very often we find that that heart wish is very connected to what's brought us to the Dharma and why we're practicing. So if we can make that connection, then, as I've said, that gives a real power to the practice. So then we moved on around the mandala to spiritual death, and we looked at just firstly the power of concepts. Remember that story of that crash in Pakistan? Yes, what we're telling ourselves about the world has a very deep effect on how we experience it. Particularly when we don't even notice the assumptions that we're making. And part of just sitting is becoming aware of those assumptions that limit us. So then we went from there into some aspects of insight, and we did a little bit about no self in the five skandhas with the aid of that story about oyster sauce. So if you missed any of Monday, the next couple of minutes may be a bit incomprehensible to you, but there we go. Discovering that there are no oysters in the oyster sauce completely changes the picture. There's that approach that maybe inevitably we take to some extent in the early parts of our Dharma life, where we're looking out for ego and we have a sense that there's something real that we're having to work against. That gradually changes, and we do start to see that what we're talking about is just a way of functioning. Yeah, it's selfing. So we looked at that approach, and then we looked a little bit at another of our assumptions, which is the whole assumption of self and other, and that whole boundary between self and other. And we did some work with looking at things in terms of experience, yeah? Everything being our experience, and that's true both for the senses which we tend to identify with, so the sense of touch, the mind sense, and also the senses which we think of as being experienced out there. You know, even what we're hearing, even what we're seeing, is clearly, it's our experience. It's an experience of mind. And we worked our way into an approach to just sitting, which involved letting the mind be very spacious, There's a strong connection between spaciousness and relaxation, too. It's like, you know, when you don't feel relaxed, it's as if the walls are kind of closing in on you. You know, there is a sense of not being able to breathe easily. There's a sense of tightness, constriction. So just allowing your mind to be very spacious already has a relaxing effect. And so we did an exercise where we went from what in Zen terms you could call small mind, sort of more of a just, here am I in here, focused down in my world, surrounded by everything else. And we opened out into what in Zen you could call big mind, where we became aware that everything's experience. So we had a sense of being, mind being like a big container for all our experience, for everything that appeared within it. We tried to have that sort of sense. And then we went from there. So we went from me in here to me as awareness, containing all experience. And then the next step is to drop the sense of me, the sense that it's my big awareness. Because where are you in all that if awareness is already... if awareness is already limitless, then where is there a me somewhere outside that that's even bigger, that has that? How does that work? So we just let go of that sense of me. I like saying these things, you know, you just let go of that sense of me. It's like, just get in touch with your heart wish, you know, just get awakened, you know, there we are. We do our best to let go of the sense that it's my awareness. So now we just have a large field of awareness within which sounds are arising, sights are arising, thoughts are arising, sensations are arising, and so on. And then but there's still a sort of subtle assumption in there of a separation between the appearances and the awareness. There's still a sense of mind is like a big container, a big bowl or something, within which all the appearances are sort of floating about, or however you want to see it. So we do our best, again, to let go of that subtle assumption. And if it all works perfectly, which it only does about 95% of the time, you're left with just aware appearances arising and passing away by themselves. That split that we've made between awareness and experience is another concept that we're putting onto our experience. So it's another bit of wallpaper that we do our best to peel off. Yeah, so we go through that sort of sequence. So from starting point as, let's call it small mind, me in here, experience out in here and out there, to sense of spaciousness, spacious awareness. Now I'm identified with everything, if you like. I'm the awareness that contains the whole thing. Then you let go of any sense that awareness is I or me or mine. And then finally, you even let go of that sense of container and contain, that sense of separate awareness and experiences.
Job done.
Yeah. There will be a T-shirt on sale for £10 in the office when you leave. Yeah. But in general, it helps with just sitting, just to get a sense of spaciousness. It's like, we haven't done it, we haven't focused much on hearing here, because you can't hear much beyond the shrine room here. It's quite well sort of insulated. But if you're sitting in a place where you can hear birds or even traffic and things like that, a very good way into just sitting is just to focus on hearing, and you just let go of, I'll stop doing it in a minute, just let go of, you do your best to let go of a sense of it sort of out there or in here, the sound. Just hear it as pure sound. But that's that sense of spaciousness which comes from focusing on sound. Particularly, you can take your mind to the most distant sound you can hear. That's quite a good way into things. Yeah. That's focusing on sound, yeah, opens a sense of space, which is quite a natural portal into just sitting. Okay. Well, in shamatha meditation, very often we're trying to shut the noises out, aren't we? But as we get more experienced with meditation, unless you're practicing some kind of deep shamatha or attempting to practice some sort of deep shamatha, I think we need, even if you're doing absorption practice, structured practice, it's quite good to learn to let the sounds in the sense that you are not just closing down. One of the dangers with meditation, I think, is that we can get a bit kind of precious, here am I, I'm doing this special thing called meditation, and I'm doing it, and you mustn't disturb me, and you just coughed, and you that's really disturbed my meditation, and really did it. That's you can have a whole sort of attitude to life which kind of is reinforced by meditation, where you end up in a sort of attic by yourself, just sitting with a beautiful image of the Buddha. And that's a trap, it's a sort of spiritual, it's not a complete sidetrack, but it's certainly, if it's a stage, you don't want it to go on too long. So what we want to be is more robust and kind of just open to experience. And even if we're practicing shamatha, after a while we're better off having the attitude that if there are sounds, well, it's up to me, it's my mind, it's up to me to deal with them and work with them, rather than those nasty sounds shouldn't be there in the first place and it's the fault of whoever's making them. Do you see what I mean? It's just, yeah. Because ultimately, what we have control over, so to speak, is our mind. So the more we take responsibility, the better. And it also helps when we're meditating in noisy places. But specifically here, to come back to your kind of question, Kamran Nandi, what I'm saying is that sound, taking the mind out to sound, helps to create a sense of spaciousness. Yeah, there's a sense of the mind opening out to include the sounds that are around. So if you take your mind to the furthest sound. And again, do your best to sort of take the labels off. So the aim is that there's just pure sound. Yeah, doing our best just to let go of that labeling process, and to let go of the labels and to let go of the judgments and the reactions. And that whole tendency that we have to action replays of sounds, it's like there's a sound and we then kind of, and it's gone in a moment, but we recreate it in order, it's like It's already gone, but then we recreate it in order to label it. It's a funny thing that we do. Yeah. So as we relax more and more and more, we let go of that tendency to recreate and to replay. We do our best to let go of the label even. And there's just the sound. Yeah, and we let go of judgments about it. I remember on the first total immersion retreat, which was up in Dharmakosha, it was Viveka and Kamala Sheila and I were doing the teaching. And one morning, Viveka was teaching, and there was a low-flying fighter jet, which sort of, we were out in a marquee because there were lots of us, and it felt like it kind of came in one end of the marquee and sort of flew straight above our heads and straight out the other end. And it just kind of, the sound was like tearing the sky in half. Viveka sort of asked people afterwards, you know, how they'd found it. And there were people going, oh, that was really horrible. And it was so unpleasant. And I felt really jarred. And why are they up there anyway? And Viveka and I could see, I just kind of caught, you know, we caught eyes with one another. Because we could both feel that actually when that had happened, all we'd felt was vroom! It was just all this kind of energy. And then it had gone. Yeah. So, yeah, we just let the sound be. If you want to investigate more with sound, you can investigate I don't know how to put this, the distance between your ear and the sound, or even where the sound is, because it gets kind of... we create this world where there's a sound out there and there's me listening to it here. If you go deeply into it, that starts to sort of collapse. Anyway, does that give you a few... pointers. Any other questions while we're at it? Pranayamati, by a short
head. Short question. Do you think it's useful to think in terms of hearing rather than listening?
I think it's really good to have a sense of that you're not actively going out there kind of searching for sound like some kind of radar thing. It's much better to... I was going to say let the sound come to you, but that's... There are concepts in there that I'm not sure I completely agree with, but... It's good to be very receptive, and I think sometimes if we think in terms of hearing rather than listening, that might help. Yeah? Swadi.
You answered my question.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
God, how do I do that? Anybody else? Moksha-bhakti. Moksha-bhakti.
Practice play.
Yes.
I've noticed any loud noise, a cough or anything.
Yeah.
I have a physical. Might be quite subtle, but there's a there's a tightening. I suppose then I can sort of choose whether to pursue that or not. I'm just wondering, perhaps I should explore it, whether all sounds, no matter how gentle, whether I have a physical reaction to them, or whether you get to a stage where any sound, no matter how subtle, you're in a state where you don't have that reaction.
Okay. I kind of sympathise. When I was a kid, I had terrible reactions to loud noises. I don't know. Maybe I was in the Blitz in last life or something. But yeah. My parents had to be really careful, you know, with what they took me to, you know. But bonfire night, I was kind of sort of under the bed with the dog, you know. I once got taken to a pantomime at the London Palladium, and it was Mother Goose, and I really enjoyed the first 10 minutes. And then Mother Goose waddled onto the stage and laid an egg with a loud sort of bang. And I was gone, I was up the aisle, I was running, my parents were looking. So, yeah, sort of sympathise. I think some of us are, for whatever reason, just are a bit sort of sensitised to loud noise. I think in some particular mental states, and even meditative states, you can be sensitised. I still remember, I can still feel being an Il Convento about 1985, meditating, and somebody with their two cushions accidentally dropping them right in front of me, and the sort of the bang, you know, the cushion hit the ground and my head almost hit the hit the ceiling. I was, you know, I was just shocked. But I think all you can do is just be aware that that's a particular sensitivity, and do what you can to just relax and let go, and, you know, catch yourself and let the tremors play themselves out. But it is possible to get to a point where even really loud, you know, explosions and things don't produce any kind of, you know, reaction in the body. So I'm told. I remember we discussed this with Tillman on our long retreat. Yeah.
I'm not particularly sensitive to sound.
Yeah. Oh, okay, right.
But there's a bodily reverberation that me gathers around and then lets go. It sort of brings in, I suppose, is it a threat, self-defense, even very subtle?
Yeah.
And then I can let go.
Yeah, yeah. Well, either there's already a subtle sense of you kind of present, so that when the sound happens, there is that feels threatened, and that creates the tremor in the body. Or you've got a sort of viparka, which is the tremor, and then the selfing comes in. Yeah. Be either way. Yeah. Dana Badri.
It's the opposite side of most of Andrew's point.
Okay.
That I meditate with my hearing aids on, because if I switch them off, I lose all the small sounds of the world.
Yeah.
And it's very isolating and quite unpleasant. In a way, you plug yourself into the system, but with the system.
Yeah. 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 Hmm. Varsity.
It's a question about something you said this morning. Do you want me to wait till later?
If you wait till later, the retreat will be gone. So.
I guess it's not completely formed, but it was about what you were saying with entrusting yourself to the three jewels.
Yeah.
And I think I get the spirit of that, but there is something that... I guess with like the magic lufgun quote, tight and loosely, in a way, there is some direction as well to entrust oneself to. Because if I just entrust myself to what I'm doing, I might just be recreating unskillful habits. Does that make sense?
Well, as long as you're on the karma niyama level of things, you look after your karma. So you keep practicing the precepts and so on. It's more like a kind of overall context that you're putting things in. It's not quite as simple as, oh, well, I've entrusted everything to the three shores. No. Tra-la-la, I shall do anything.
There's something I don't get in that. I don't quite know what it is, because I can get that on a karma niyama level, well, you need to have some sort of principles that you try and apply effort to live by it.
Mm-hmm. It's almost as well as that, you're kind of inviting in or opening yourself to some kind of deeper principle. I'm not quite sure what.
Maybe the thing that, maybe the missing link in my understanding is then that you are practicing and you are trying to put the Dharma into life.
Mm-hmm.
I guess.
Yeah.
But with that, then there is that sense of also, well, it, to some extent, it's also beyond your control. You just practice.
Yeah.
Is that a bit what you were?
Yes, partly that, and also you're not too concerned about the results.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not just practicing to make sure my karma is all right, so I'll get a better rebirth or feel happier or something, but because something bigger is important than that.
There's that aspect of it, and then there are also, as it were, deeper forces at play in things. Yeah.
I didn't quite
understand
this morning.
Does it feel like it's linked up now?
Yeah, I feel it's linked now.
Okay. Any more? It's kind of probably last chance for questions, actually. Vajrasadi.
About 10 years ago, I thought there was a bit of a dispute about just sitting that emerged, in which there were certain teachers who were promoting just sitting as a standalone practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I recall Bante warning quite strongly against that. So as a follower of Bante, I didn't do just sitting as a standalone practice, but as something that set me up for the other four practices in our spiritual discipline. And I'm not sure, as of now, after being here for 5 days, what you're teaching in relation to just sitting and the rest of the system of spiritual discipline.
Mm-hmm. One or two things I could say about that. Firstly, I've never understood Bante's teaching on just sitting as being just something that sets you up for doing the other practices. Yeah. So in the System of Meditation talk from 1978, what he's saying is that just sitting is an important counterpoint to structured practice. So a well-balanced practice could be mindfulness of breathing, just sitting, metta bhavana, just sitting. Yeah. So yes, he taught just sitting as a sort of just settling practice for new people. You know, it's like you come along and you're not actually ready to, as it were, formally meditate, but you just give your mind a chance to quieten. So, yeah, I see just sitting firstly as more than just a setup. Yeah, I see it as all the way through spiritual life. Yeah, it's one of the two great sort of poles, if you like, of meditation, the structured practice and there's just sitting. And personally, like on 3-year retreat, I had periods where, of perhaps a few months, where I was doing, say, mainly sadhana practice, and then I'd have a period of a few months where I'd be doing just sitting. And that worked well. I think for some of us, if we're aiming to balance things out, some of us spent 10, 20, 30 years just doing structured practice pretty much. So if we're to balance that out, we may need to do quite a lot of just sitting. And I think particularly as your practice matures, just sitting may become for some people where their how their practice flowers. It is actually the natural expression of their going for refuge on a cushion is just sitting. I also think that as you get older, see if I can put this in the right sort of way. Well, for myself, it's like, you know, I've been practicing ever since 1872, and over that time, you know, I've done my best, well, something like my best, to work on aspects of myself that I saw needed work. So there are some things that I've got reasonably good positive habits about now. You know, some aspects I have managed to transform. Then there are the bits that I either have blind spots about, or I didn't recognise as being an issue, or I just never liked the look of working on them, so I never quite got around to doing that. Now they've had all that, you know, 142 years in which to get set in concrete. Now I can work at them, like with structured practice, you know, kind of working against those tendencies. But it's actually really uphill trench warfare stuff. And it actually seems to be far more effective to just sit in a completely relaxed way and allow those things to unravel than it does to work, you know, kind of directly, you know, putting effort into working against them. So for those reasons, I think that, you know, for some people, you know, just sitting may be something that they do quite a lot, and as a standalone practice. Now, in order to do that, I think that you do need to be able to maintain clarity and absorption. I think a lot of people benefit from doing shorter periods of just sitting, but as the session goes on, actually they start to drift. They lose the clarity, and they may not just be completely drifting, but there's a sort of subtle drifting. So I think for a lot of people, sort of shorter sessions are actually quite good, because you can maintain a kind of a clarity and a sharpness. Yeah, the awareness stays nice and bright, which you need. Going back to what Bhante said, I think you'd have to ask. You could ask Dhammarati, maybe. Well, I won't put you on the spot unless you want to be on the spot. Sorry. Yep. What was that?
So far, so good.
So far, so good. Okay. Yeah. I think, yeah, over the years, you know, Bhante has very carefully set up, you know, a system of practice, you know, based on all his years of practice and what his teachers gave him, that he feels is consistent, that works, all the different elements work together, and very naturally, you know, he's concerned to safeguard that. Which means that when things come in that he wasn't asked about. There was no clear attempt to check with him whether this squared with how he taught. The first natural response is to go, well, hang on a minute, you know. And I think that some years ago, some people got very infused with sort of pure awareness and that sort of approach, but they didn't manage to communicate and negotiate enough to see how and whether and where that approach really fitted into our system of meditation. And I think that caused difficulties, reactions, you know, understandably. So I think we're getting to a point now where we're developing a process, a much clearer process for bringing new things into Triratna, which, whilst at the same time making sure that we keep a real sort of commonality of practice and that our system of meditation is consistent and we all understand the basic principles, so even if we're working on different aspects of it, we can still appreciate, okay, I'm practicing like this, you're practicing like that, but I understand how you're practicing and why you're practicing like that. So all that's really important. Otherwise, you know, we have a fissiparous, something which comes apart. Yeah. Fragmenting, yeah. It's a cause of fragmentation rather than unity. So we have to see how these things are helpful for going for refuge, and we have to be able to recognise one another's going for refuge in it. And I think that is happening with just sitting. Yeah. Maybe there's more to discuss, I don't know. But, I think that our system is still in process of development, but I'd certainly see, for some people, standalone just sitting would be a very useful thing.
Contradiction.
Yes. Complete contradiction in terms. Does that give you a...
Can I just add one thing that just about an experience? I also seem to remember that even earlier that debate about just sitting touched on, if you do loads of it, you can get headaches. And I'd just say that I've never had a headache in 20 years of practice, but I had a little one this week. and I add that was probably an overwillful application.
I think you can manage to get headaches during just about any practice if you go about it in the wrong way, unfortunately. Yeah. Okay.
Little question of these from what you just said.
Yeah, from the poll.
The dhyanas, would they be any equivalent in this sort of system of practice that would connect with the clarity and absorption that you were talking about?
Yes, if you're practicing just sitting, you're not aiming to develop dhyana particularly, but you can become very absorbed in this practice. Yeah, you just really can be immersed in the sensations, in the sounds. For some people, just sitting can actually be a very good way into an absorbed practice. For some people, for whatever reason, it engages you. It may engage them more than some other practices do. So, But yes, it's not, we're not sitting with just sitting, you are just sitting, so you aren't trying to get anywhere in that sense, so you're not even trying to get into dhyana. Which isn't to say that dhyana isn't a useful and helpful thing. So,
briefly, some people could do just sitting as a standalone practice. Do you mean just sitting in terms of how you've taught it here? Because it seems to me it's not a standalone practice. You sort of set it all out. So rather than doing it as you've taught it, I'm in fact doing all the practices.
Well, yeah. And actually, I think the term standalone practice, if you always do a practice in a context, there's always a view that you're bringing to the practice that you're doing, for starters, and then there's it's never quite as simple as a standalone practice. I mean, part of the issue, I think, with lots of just sitting without any structured practice was that it was a standalone in the sense that it hadn't been integrated into even our understanding fully of system of practice. It was just over there, not fully integrated or understood. But yes, the way I'm encouraging us to practice is that it is part of our whole system of practice, and you move into it via perhaps other aspects of our system of practice, and if it feels like just sitting isn't sustainable, you revert back to something more, some support. Yeah, so a lot of what I'm teaching is not just giving just sitting a place within the system, but it is, as you say, it's actually just sitting with a bit of some other practice there to support it or help sustain it.
It's in the middle, it's the central, which is significant, I believe, that it is in the middle of the
Well, spiritual receptivity sort of informs the whole of the mandala. It should aims to inform all the aspects of our experience. You could make a very crude and not very satisfactory kind of correlation between the four sides of the mandala and put sort of integration equals kind of the body, because the main practice is you need to be grounded, the main practice is mindfulness of breathing. So you can say you're being receptive to all aspects of the body. Then you have positive emotions, so you're receptive to all aspects of your emotional life. You're receptive to all your kind of thinking and views and all that, and you're receptive to deep intuition and to all the sort of depth of experience that's possible. So in that way, spiritual receptivity is not just supported by the four sides of the mandala, it is the whole mandala. It's what makes the whole mandala possible as a mandala. Maybe that's... Is that enough? Yeah. More? Vijayamala.
I just wanted to check out. Am I right in thinking that with the system of practice, in a way it was taking the emphasis of the actual structure of the practice? And bringing out the different qualities of the different areas of practice. Yeah. So in a way, you've got integration, and normally we do that through the mindfulness of breathing. But
Sorry.
But the idea is to bring out the importance of the factor of integration so that in any practices that we were doing, we were aware of that and bringing that more into being. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So although we've been teaching just sitting, there are aspects of receptivity that actually you can put in to any practice. I mean, I think this is what you're saying, Lisandra. I just think that the paper sort of really brought that out for me. It took away the emphasis on a particular, you know, I do the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana, and then I go on to do other practices, to actually looking at the qualities that I was bringing into my meditation practice and my dharma practice as a whole, which I found very, very liberating, really.
It's kind of a natural movement, isn't it? If you learn anything new, you don't really understand the principles, you haven't had an experience of what it would be like to do it deeply, so you have to be given some kind of method which leads you in that direction. Yeah. And to start with, you think in terms of the method. But then as time goes on, you start to feel the qualities, you start to get a sense of what the whole thing is pointing at, you understand the principles. And then you may carry on using the method, or you may let it go. And it's like sadhana practice. Yeah, you start, okay, you're given a sadhana, and you do it maybe as, if you're given a traditional visualization or one of those, say, visualization of Avalokiteshvara, you start off, you do it as best you can, as you've been told it. But the aim of the practice isn't to go through the sadhana as written down. You know, the aim is to bring about a change of state. The aim of all practice is to bring about a change of state, to put you in touch with something deeper. So in the case of Avalokiteshvara, with wisdom and compassion. So the danger is always that we fall into formalism and we just end up doing the method very faithfully. I mean, I'm amazed at the tremendous sort of loyalty and faithfulness of order members, some of whom do some forms of practice, you know, quite religiously for years, long after that way of doing it has kind of had any life in it at all. So yeah, all the methods, they are just ways, they're all doorways, they're all gateways into an experience. And the more we understand the principles that are underlying that, and the more we have experience of the kind of change of state and the qualities that that method is aiming to help us to get to, then we can sometimes find our other ways, or more direct ways, or simpler ways, to get to that change of state, to get to those qualities, based on the principles. So the issue isn't, you know, how much time we're spending sitting doing something called just sitting. The issue is all about what effect is that happening. How is that changing our state, if it is changing our state? Not that just sitting is trying to change your state from a certain point of view, but anyway. What qualities is that developing? You know, what are the underlying principles in all that? So that's the discussion always. It's not, you know, am I doing, you know, more than the allowed time of you know, sitting, just practicing just sitting. Okay, we'll stop there and let's do one more period of practice together.